May I invite everyone to come in and be seated. I welcome you to section number 263. This is entitled Suicide Conversations with My Son. May I remind you, as always, that we ask you to turn off cell phones or other noisemakers or anything that might provide a distraction. Our speaker this afternoon, a special treat to have him back in Salt Lake City. For some of us, the Deseret News hasn't been nearly as much fun to read since he hasn't been writing there. But we have Clifton H. Jolly with us. He is president of Advent Communications, a former journalist, as I mentioned, wrote for the Deseret News, and many of us have delightful memories of his writings there. He taught English at BYU, and I know some of you will know him from there, and was also an instructor in the church education system. So with that brief introduction, I am going to turn the time to Clifton Jolly, and he will give his presentation and has indicated that he will reserve some time for your questions at the end, at which point we'll use this microphone right down here. So, Clifton.
Oh, thank you. Wonderful. This is my granddaughter, who I don't see frequently enough for her to remember who I am until about this point in the presentation. So, Calvin and my sister Cheryl, we make up half the audience. Did Bob actually stay when he came in? There's Bob Reese. As I was coming down the hall, I couldn't help but notice who I was competing with. And with all of these topics on Jesus, I can't imagine what you're doing here. Because the title of this talk, I want to begin by telling you, is not metaphorical. It's about suicide. And it's not about theoretical suicide, it's about my suicide. Let me explain. This is the beginning of a book that I am writing with my son Calvin. I have six children, of whom Calvin is the eldest, and I'm certain that his siblings, who have heard of the project and of its title, are horrified both by the title and the presumption of our book, because they think that this book is about Calvin. It's not. It's about me. My wife Abigail recently asked me, "Why is it that it's always about you, Clifton?" To which I replied, "I don't know. It just always is." When I was a columnist at the Deseret News, one of my colleagues on the city desk, that's out where the real reporters live, anonymously posted on the city desk bulletin board a copy of an essay that I had written, and in red pen circled all the personal pronouns. There seemed to be dozens of them. My response the following day was to publish an essay in which I trebled the number of personal pronouns. I'm told the event was so frightening to the real reporters that paramedics were called for oxygen because I had sucked all the air out of the room. The Haggadah of the Passover Seder for the Jewish people's instruction of the young teaches the importance of Passover, the celebration of being saved, of being delivered, what they're talking about in the other rooms, with Jesus. And it tells that to each different child, there needs to be a different kind of instruction. For my six children, although they were not raised as Jews, they were raised as Mormons, had they been raised as Jews, there would have been only one instruction appropriate to them. It is the one that is used to teach the wicked child, the rebellious child, the difficult child, because while all of my children have turned out very well, like Calvin, there isn't one of them that was easy. It's my personal belief that the reason the church promotes having children quickly is that after the first one becomes a teenager, all childbearing stops. To the wicked child, one says, "When we came out of Egypt, this is what the Lord God said unto me, not to you, but to me." So this book, for which Calvin and I are writing alternating chapters, and which I'm certain Calvin believes to be his book, is not. This is a book about the time when I killed myself. Unsuccessfully, as it turned out. But I'm of the opinion that you can call yourself a poet even if you write really, really bad poems. You're just a bad poet, as I am obviously a pretty bad suicide. And the only evidence I need of how bad a suicide I am is, well, I'm here. Calvin and I are writing this book to discover a conversation, a language by which to discuss the terrible truths of our independent suicides, and to admit to ourselves whether or not we're any good at it. Not at the act of suicide itself, which neither one of us, as it turns out, are very good at, but at the education that fathers give their sons and sons their fathers. Because Calvin and I pretty much taught each other about suicide, about the need for it, about the hope that it is possible to take in it. At least I certainly taught him. But in all the years that have separated us from those events, we've never really talked about them. In the short, happy life of Francis McCumber, when McCumber is trying to explain to the white hunter what it feels like to kill a lion and to be a man, the hunter says that while he knows what McCumber is talking about, it really doesn't do to talk about it. Men don't do that. You know? The strong silence of the Hemingway man. But as we now know historically, Hemingway was a disappointment to everyone, to his wives, his mistresses, his children, and ultimately to his critics. And in the end, with his unfinished exercise of Islands in the Stream, even he recognized that he had been wrong. Not about just a thing, but about everything. Silence is not a vocabulary. Killing lions is not what it means to be a man. To be a man, we kill ourselves, even when we do it very badly. What I've learned about killing myself is that people who have hope only in this life are stuck. The Hemingway proof of life, the Hemingway test, is designed to validate people who sleep with other people's wives. It's designed to validate a kind of man not capable of language, a kind of father who knows only the killing of other living things. McCumber ultimately has his head blown off by his wife. which in one way or another happens to us all. But for some of us, the eventuality of that death, that symbolic dying, has its more hopeful moment in the possibility of the death that we take upon ourselves. I met a gentleman by the name of Saul Kent in 1985. As president of the North American Life Extension Foundation, he was funding life extension research at UCLA, Stanford, and a number of other universities. You know, Bob, I think we actually had lunch when I was, you remember William, Dr. Walford, Bill Walford, in the medical school? I was working on a documentary at the time. Saul also had cryogenics labs in Southern California and in Florida. And for those of you who don't know, cryogenics are essentially tombs that where corpses are kept in a kind of nitrogen cold storage, so that as science eventually progresses to a stage that it can cure the diseases that killed the person, they can be thawed out. The repair of whatever malady killed them can be made, and then they can be ushered into a kind of eternal life of renewable or replaceable body parts, forever, ever living in this world. If you had known Saul Kent, you would have known what a terrible possibility that seems. Well, I was producing a documentary funded by Saul about life extension, an enthusiasm that at the time seemed a little cockeyed to me, but in point of fact, in the intervening decades, it has pretty much become the preoccupation of millions of us baby boomers who, like a 21st century Rip Van Winkle, have awakened to the horror of becoming old. The documentary gave me the opportunity to meet and interview a number of luminaries in the field of wellness and what some at the time called death prevention, and not just mid-level wackos like Saul, but serious scientists like Dr. Walford, who later published the New York Times bestseller, The 120-Year Diet, and became one of Biosphere 2's first bionauts. I don't know do any of you remember Biosphere 2? Yeah. It was a project funded and run by another group of wackos, and itself an altogether different story, but also focused on this idea that we should never, ever, ever die. Well, Saul's funding for the documentary dried up, and the next time I bumped into him was in 1988. It was in Los Angeles, where I was in a hotel, and I turned on the evening news to hear a story that was later reported in Newsweek. And as it turns out, Saul was reported to having stolen his mother's head, which is not an easy trick unless you have first removed the head, which evidently Saul had done. Saul's mother had been in an intensive care facility where Saul was reported to have cut off her head so as to have it frozen so that she might be brought back to life on someone else's better body. She said, "That is unbelievable." This is a good indication when people seek to replace Jesus, what they find is inevitably much more ridiculous than what they had to begin with. Well, the question was whether or not Saul had taken his mother's head after she died or just before she died. Well, Saul was a little strange, but one would not immediately think of him just kind of whacking off his mother's head in anticipation of her death. But it occurred to me that one of the things Saul most liked to talk about was the damage that death does to the brain, to the skull cap. I don't know how he discovered this, but evidently The brain is really, really good right up until the moment of death. And then the process of death just wreaks all kinds of havoc with the brain cells. And so as Saul had said, if you can harvest the head, his words, not mine, if you can harvest the head just prior to the moment of death, you can essentially get a pristine brain, which is a good thing if you're planning on putting it on somebody else's body and bringing it back in a few years. So I immediately got on the phone and I called my children's mother and I said, have you by any chance heard anything from Saul Kent? She said, crazy Saul? No, why? I said, well, it doesn't really matter, but if he shows up and is carrying a hat box, don't look in the box. Well, what does this have to do with me killing myself? Well, number one, if I kill myself, please do not bring me back. Don't want to be frozen. Don't want to be returned on somebody else's better body. Certainly don't want to come back with somebody else's brain. And it also occurred to me that people who take hope in this life with that kind of ferocity, with that sort of intensity, have a very different opinion of life than people like you and me. And I begin to wonder what it is precisely about death that frightens us. And I also wonder why it is that we don't take greater comfort in the possibility. Now, I'm a fairly recent survivor of prostate cancer. And when I read recently at a Sunstone symposium in Southern California, I was not kind to the medical science. And are there any doctors in the room? But we can speak freely nevertheless. My father was an oral surgeon, kind of a half doctor, you know, a dentist. And father used to say about medical science that essentially what we do is we study fixes for things that won't necessarily kill us. And he says, 10%, 5%, 7% of what happens to you is going to kill you no matter what you do. And 85% of what happens to you will get better if you just don't pick at it. And so doctors take care of the other 10%. Would you agree, generally speaking? He's not going to give up the argument immediately, but it's a argumentative point. It became a practical question for me, since I was an unsuccessful suicide, as to whether or not, how much I was prepared to do to go on living in this life, if in fact I take hope in the life that follows this, as I do, in point of fact. And when they began to describe what the cures for prostate cancer are, is everyone familiar with the treatment of prostate cancer? All the women, none of the men, probably. That was my experience. And my wife knows everything about prostate cancer, and I still know only what she told me to do. And for prostate cancer, you can do a variety of things, all of which have to do with the death of a piece of yourself, in one way or another. You're going to stop being able to hold your water, or you're going to stop being able to make love in the ways that you have physically become accustomed to, or you're going to experience various other kinds of humiliations of the flesh, more significantly, humiliations of the ego, and you pretty well come to the idea that you ain't going to be killing many more lions. Now, my wife cheered me up by assuring me that my lion killing really hadn't been that terrific from the beginning. Which was curiously not very comforting for me. But as we looked at the various possibilities, she began to reassure me, with statistical evidences, which is frequently what medical science does for us. And the statistical evidences, if you're a surgeon, is that a radical prostatectomy, I've come to the conclusion, I don't like any medical term having to do with my body that begins with radical. I like moderate, you know, small, little changes. Radical prostatectomy kind of sounds like a radical lobotomy. Radical prostatectomy is likely to result in between 5 and 20% incontinence and between 15 and 30% chance of impotence, which my wife assured me were pretty doggone good odds. And to demonstrate to her how differently we think about life and death and health and progress in this life, this veil of tears, as we were driving and talking about this, I picked up a pencil from the tray between us and I held it very near her eye and said, there are only one chances in three that I'm going to stab you with this and blind you. How good are the odds? And she said, put down the pencil, Clifton. You aren't killing any lions today. The odds become remarkably changed if we begin to ask ourselves important questions about our lives. The kinds of questions that believing peoples really should be asking all the time, but it occurs to me that we seldom do. My father, who was a great and good man, a psychologist, and a stake president, once made the observation, Mormons are very, very good at the theory of Christianity. Theoretically, we're very good at repentance, for instance, so long as nobody sins. We don't like sinners very much. We don't like to hear about it very much. When was the last time anyone got up in fast and testimony meeting and really confessed their specific sins? People have already begun to flee the room, me talking about my very real attempt to suicide. And I would suggest to you it's not a topic that we should necessarily be talking about. We should be talking about life and redemption, the fact that we are all going to be resurrected from the dead, rather than focusing on death itself. But the fact of the matter is that for people who take more hope in life than they do in the death that is promised to us all, how confident is our faith in that moment? Now, I quite frankly confess to you that when I considered and practiced my own suicide, it was not as an act of faith. It was not as an act of hope. It was an act of desperation. It was an act of humiliation. It was defeat. And in a way, I suppose it was one of the closest times that I've ever been to God. And it was really unpleasant. As a matter of fact, I'm most comfortable when I most distance myself from God. I love television. Television is my principal exercise. I had an opportunity to speak a number of years ago at BYU after I had written a documentary that had been on PBS. And the writing students asked me, what goals do you have for yourself? And I said, more television. And they said, you mean you want to do more documentaries for television? I said, no, I want to watch more television. I like to eat. I like to go to the movies. I like to sit in the park and think about and do nothing at all. As a matter of fact, one of the most serious difficulties I got into at the Deseret News, I remember the five articles. One of them I wrote about Michael. I'll never do that again. Michael Quinn is trouble in anybody's book. The other time I wrote about the fact that Mormons lose track of the fact that work was given to us as a curse. How did we become such an industrious people? How did we get that stupid beehive as the symbol for the colony? All these mindless workers running around, you know, servicing the queen. I mean, this is a horrible concept when what we were supposed to be was in a garden, eating the fruit from the trees, all but one, and naming animals. You get up, you name a few animals, you eat a little fruit, it's a good day, you go to sleep. How is it that we came from that to Zion, the honeybee? And I would suggest to you that part of it has to do with the necessity of distancing ourselves from the very real and terrible facts of our living. It's really much easier not to think about God. It's very much easier not to worry about the relevance that God has in our lives and what is going to be required of us as a result of that. And I would suggest to you that the people who spend too very much time doing that wind up killing themselves pretty much one way or the other, either in this life or in this career or in that religious context. At least all the good people I know have. So few good people left living today, don't you think? Isn't that what you find? Haven't all the really interesting people pretty much killed themselves? Well, not me, I'm still with you. But then I'm failed at the good things in life. When my son returned from India, where he had gone to find the truth, and where I was certain that he had died because he couldn't pick up the telephone to make a collect call home. In all those months and years of his absence, knowing that his father was at home, believing him to be dead, he couldn't pick up the phone and call home. How long were you actually gone, son? Better than a year. He was gone a year without calling home to his father. And he came up the driveway of our home in Cottonwood, hair down to his waist, barefoot. And he walked up to me and he said words that will ring in me until I die. I want to learn to type. I said, you have been more than a year in India seeking the truth. You told me you could not learn from me. And you learned that you need to type? He said, no, I learned you can't find the truth in India, but I also need to type. And I said, well, I have the typing tutor I bought for you when you were 15 and never opened. Go thou and do likewise. And he went into my office and came out a week later typing about 65 words a minute. And everything changed from learning to type. And I began to ask myself, slightly after then, precisely how much of what I knew and did not know was, in fact, a mistake. How mistaken had I been over all of those years about living and dying, and what it meant to do them both, and what it meant to be a good Christian, and what it meant to be a good Mormon, and how few good Mormons there were left alive, and how many were dying every day by their hands, by somebody else's hand. And I also began to look around at the casualties of our living, about the world in which we live and living our very, very best every day. How we nevertheless disappoint and humiliate and fail to save some of the brightest and the best and the youngest and the truest. How we disappoint our children, how we betray their hope, how we fail to satisfy their expectations, that in our lives there is any hope. I began to look around at my friends' children and my own children, and I began to wonder why it was that after all those family home evenings and after all of that anxiety and fasting and prayer, I still seemed to be doing such a bad job. And I remember Elder Packer promising that if we would have our family home evenings, our children would not go astray. Do any of you remember that sermon? Great sermon. I preached against it. It seemed unreasonable. But in my heart of hearts, I trusted in it. I expected it to work. The problem is my children heard the sermon and were dead certain to prove Elder Packer wrong. And maybe that's the trick. Maybe it works so long as you don't let your children know what you're trying to do to them. Turn them into good little Mormons. Maybe that's the problem, is that we are defeated by what our children know and what they learn. And so, as I considered what had been lost and what I had not been able to retain, I began to wonder, how do you go about making good raspberry jam? Because that's the evidence of a farm life, isn't it? How many have had good raspberry freezer jam? See, you know? If you can figure out how to make good raspberry jam and take hope in it, that can pretty much work. Because there is a truth in that. Nobody goes to raspberry jam expecting anything other than they get, do they? But our children come to us, it seems to me, frequently expecting to get something very much other than we're prepared to give them. I still haven't discovered exactly what it is, but I'm absolutely certain that it probably isn't family home evening. Might have been, perhaps, if you'd done a better job of it than I did. But ultimately, there was a way in which I found to live the gospel or not to live the gospel that disappointed my children, all of them but one. Because five of my six children are like me. One of them went on a mission. All good children, all good adults, all good people, and all of them in various ways failed suicides because they've grown up in this environment that we've created for ourselves at Sunstone. I think, Bob, you remember on a New Year's Eve at Ed Barner's house, conversation we had, and Bob said to me, he said, you know, I wonder if I've done my children a favor by teaching them to question, by teaching them to wonder, by teaching them to be me. Is that right? Is that, I capture it? And I said, no, I'm pretty sure you haven't, you know. Because I look around and I see children who don't ask those questions doing a lot better. And so I think that we've found the wrong way. And Bob, God bless him, argued with me. At that point, he realized we were going down the wrong road. It was a rhetorical question. It wasn't, you know, he said, well, but we all have to get to that point. And I don't think that's true. It can't be true. Because I look around at the children of other people who don't ask questions, and I guarantee you, they are never coming to this point. They will never question, they will never wonder. They'll go to the temple, they'll die, and they'll go to heaven. That is the track that they are on, which means that this track is not essential. And if this track is not essential, why do we do it? Why do we kill ourselves over and over again, every season, every session? Why these suicides? And always coming back, hoping that the answer will turn out differently? I think God accepts us all pretty much as we are, and I think that part of the mistake that I have come to understanding is that what I thought was the proper way just doesn't make any sense in terms of the way we live our lives. That my son going to India and breaking his father's heart for over a year was exactly what was supposed to happen. That is our life. In Psalms, thou hast put gladness in my heart. I will both lay me down in peace and sleep, for thou, Lord, only makest me to dwell in safety. I don't understand this dangerous and difficult safety that God speaks of. There was a time when I thought I did. There was a time when I thought things were going to pretty much work out, pretty much as I planned. And I lived with friends who took hope in that safety as I did. And we have all of us been disappointed together. When I was writing for the spoken word, in one of the pieces I did for the Tabernacle Choir, I spoke about the prophecy that more matters to me now, I think. And it's the prophetic expression that I now remember and that I cherish. And at that dark time, when medical science can no longer prop me up, I think it is the confidence that I will last reach across that dark abyss and take the hand of Adam or whoever else is there to accept me. I'm going to take half a second and read this, and then I'm done. No, I'm not. I'm just going to read this. Because when I consider my own suicide, and when I consider the suicides of my friends, the people I have loved and who have loved me, and I think of the hope that we must all of us take, not in this life, but in the impulse that the desperate and the hopeless have in believing that there is a power beyond this and there is a life that will ease the wounds we have suffered here. This is called Last Fruit, and it's for the son of a good friend. Quietly, through the silent snow to tell your beads, but softly in the canyon and the trees where his soul may yet be tangled in the branches, cold in late snow, early spring. Listen for him clattering in the ice storm as he remembers poems, slightly singing low. Watch for his mad memory and your memorization that will not hold his face, his hand. Early harvest, last fruit. go into the canyon and the trees, to harrow in the hoar frost what did not take root. This consequence of everything we did and did not do. Do not be sad or fearful. Every dark imagination must come true. And in the ice and branches we yet may find him, dancing on the air, singing through the frost, tracing his long, sweet hair. Go into the canyon. He is caught in nets of branches and of air. Quietly, so you do not frighten him again, who was so frightened and so spare of obligation to have suffered as we suffer in the world. He's waiting. He's safe. He has found the spring that does not fall in snow. His peace is the peace we all will know. You'll find him hanging in the trees. Last fruit, first free. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Clifton. We do have several minutes for those who would like to engage in some dialogue with Clifton. If you'd come to the microphone here, Mike.
I'd like to say that the poem that Clifton read was about my son Adam, who after 21 years of struggling to fit into a world that did not understand him, and the struggle, which I think was probably a high form or low grade, however you want to think it, of a mental disorder. He found that his only alternative was to escape, and so he hung himself on a tree in City Creek. And this dialogue about life and death and suicide, this is an important dialogue. But for me, as the surviving father of a miserably unhappy son, it's also a dialogue that I hope will extend to other miserable sons and daughters and to their miserable parents.
Clifton, you don't know this, but I have a son who took his life at 35. And it was such a shock. I also am a survivor of a failed attempt of years before. It was such a shock to me. It was 10 years ago now, wasn't it, honey? 10 years. And my wife, Brigitte, is the one who informed me. I was in California. He took his life in Santa Fe. And so I felt, if I'd ever felt any kind of success, it was gone. And I can only imagine what Michael has felt. But what's happened in the years since is that the family came together at his death. My family, my children, came from all over the country. Some very active Mormons, some not even a member of the church at all. Many judgmentals, but our family came together for a week. And in crying and repenting and realizing what has happened, and that all this other stuff meant nothing. And that began a reconciliation of us all. And we've never, it was sweet, it was tragic, it was sad, But at the very end, my oldest boy said, "Dad, Ivan has brought the family together. The family knew what to do," which was a miracle for us. And it began a whole new life. And so he lives in us, and we celebrate his life every year.
Everyone knows Gene's crazy. I mean, magnificently so. And the weirdness in all of us is what makes it difficult, I think, to know and to anticipate. One of the things that I have learned, however, is that as a people, we are too quick to congratulate in ourselves the suffering of others. And so I know that we learn from these terrible events. I know that that there is healing and reconciliation. But I remember as a polio child myself, crippled as a child, I remember in primary, you remember this poem about the guy who's sad and he's on a bus and he sees this blind person get on. And he says, he thinks to himself, "I have two eyes, the world is mine." Did they only tell that in Highland Park, California? Or I thought they told it in primary everywhere. And then this person without an arm gets on, and he thinks, "I have two hands, the world is mine." And then this crippled kid gets on. He says, "I have two legs." And I said, "Wait a minute. I'm the negative example. Everybody is cheering themselves up about being whole because I'm crippled. How is that helpful?" I can't imagine that. I mean, there's this horrible concept that, you know, retarded children, we are sent here to test, and retarded children are sent here to be the test. What an awful doctrine, you know, that God would make people retarded to test us. There is something so monstrous in our inability to simply take suffering in the teeth and to realize that I'm depressed, you're depressed, and that's kind of the way the world works. You know, that there are terrible, hard times, and there are things beyond which none of us do a very good job of going beyond. And what separates us from tragedy is it's a moment. You know, in the Greek concept, the distance between tragedy and comedy is point of view. You know, your tragedy is a comedy to me. It's a horrible concept, but if you think about it, Schlegel says that when we see tragedy, it works not for the reason of catharsis in the audience or because of the transformation of the tragic hero. The reason tragedy works is because after Oedipus has killed his father and slept with his mother and blinded himself, our first response is, "Oh my God, I'm glad that's not me." And that's terrible. When I was writing for the Deseret News, we were having our home appraised, and the appraiser said, "You're Clifton Jolly, you write for the newspaper, you tell stories." And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Can I tell you a story?" And he said, my daughter, getting off the school bus, slipped on the ice and went under the wheel, and the bus rolled over her and killed her. This was 6 months ago, 7 months ago. He said, "And I'm the bishop of the ward. And I see, you know, the ward all came together and they were wonderful and helpful, and after 3 or 4 months, I could see it in their eyes. Why doesn't he get over it? He's the bishop. Why doesn't he get over it? And he said, I can't. He said, there is some pain that believing makes worse. Great story. I met him a year later, and I asked him how he was doing. He said, much better, thank you. I said, really? What answer did you discover? He said, I have an inoperable brain tumor. I don't have to do this very much longer. Sometimes suicide's the answer. It's not an easy answer. It's not a good answer. It's not the right answer, maybe. But we so easily condemn and judge and wonder about the suffering of others. It's our own suffering we take seriously, you know. All I know about suicide is some people are good at it and some people aren't. That's it. God bless you, you know. Too bad that your son was good. Thank God mine wasn't, you know.
In that case, we'll thank Clifton Jolly for provoking us to deep thought and contemplation, and we'll move to our next session. Thank you.